and sound judgment, the hallmarks of a liberal arts perspective. December 5th evening information session at details at merrillhurst.edu. This is KBOO Portland coming up at 10:30. We will hear a panel discussion on the history of the Mountain Moving Cafe, exploring collectives at work. This program was recorded on November 14th as part of the History of Social Justice Organizing series. Thank you, Janka Soderberg and Tom Hood, for recording this program. The panelists who will be speaking are Ellen Goldberg, Andy Clark, Kieran O'Hara, and Peter Thacker. The panel is introduced by Sandy Polishuk, the organizer of the History of Social Justice series. And here it is.
Now, on to Mountain Movie Cafe, a beloved institution. I'm not going to tell you about it, though, but I am going to introduce these four members of the original collective who still live in Portland, and I just want to say I'm really grateful that you all agreed to be here tonight. As I was coming here, I was thinking about it, and I realized that they were all teachers, but Peter and Andy went on to make teaching their lifetime career, and Ellen and Kira are both cultural workers. Kira is a musician, and Ellen is a poet. And this so perfectly represents what Mountain Moving was, which was an educational, cultural, community, institution, gathering place, and restaurant. really, really pleased to have them all here. I'm just going to tell you briefly what's been going on in their lives since the cafe. Andy worked as a laborer for how many years, did you say? You can't get away from it. Several years. He built some big things in this town, but then he became a math teacher. And he is retired from that. He taught for 20 years, and now he writes math textbooks, and he works for school districts around the country to try to improve the teaching of math. Ellen, since she left the cafe, has done a multitude of things. She's done carpentry. She helped build Nordstrom's. She ran companies. She was a performing public for the city. She has taught ABE, I don't know what ABE is, adult basic ed, okay, and GED to high school dropouts. She taught at Jefferson, teaching English. She went on to get her social work degree and worked as a child and family therapist for the past 15 years at CARES Northwest, the Regional Child Abuse Assessment Center, until she retired last year. But I think of her as a poet. She has published, and she reads, and she's, now that she's retired, we hope to see many, many, many more poems from her. Peter Thacker is now a teacher of teachers at the University of Portland, but before that, he spent 27 years in the Portland Public Schools as a high school literacy and English teacher. And before that, before even Mountain Moving Cafe, he worked in alternative schools with kids of all ages. And he said that Mountain Moving was just one of his forays outside of education, that he's always had a passion for social justice and for collective decision making. Kira O'Hara left the cafe in 78 or 79, she's not sure, after which she did kitchen work and clerical jobs and played jazz in Portland. Until 1987, when she went back to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, which was her original home. And while she was there, she earned a teaching certificate and a master's degree. She worked there, and of course she played music. Then she came back here in 94 and worked at Patton House, a low-income assisted living facility, and continued to play music. Since 98, she's done administrative support for nonprofit mental health and addiction agency, and she's always played music, and she stopped working full-time just last summer, of course, still a musician. So I'm just going to hand it over to them. This is the first time I've done a panel of people that weren't just had a relationship, but in terms of the subject matter, but who actually all work together. And so we decided they're just going to have a conversation and try not to interrupt each other and do it.
Well, first, we decided we would talk about the context, that historical context that the cafe came out of, because so much was going on.
That was good.
Well, actually, many of the people here were involved in much of the... Oh, sorry. Many of the people here were involved in all of these things, but in many of the things that were occurring at the time. But I think it is important to sort of contextualize this, that this was the early, mid-70s. This was Nixon. The war was ending. Watergate happened. The war was coming to an end. A lot of us had come to think in terms of ourselves as having spent a lot of time in the anti-war movement. This was also growth of feminism. 73 was the Roe v. Wade decision. A few years earlier, 69 or 70, was the growth of the gay liberation movement. And so there was the context was many of us had come out of political movements or feminism, and there were there was a wealth of kind of institutions at that time. There were food co-ops. There were what else? Besides food co-ops?
KBOO.
KBOO.
The media.
The women's clinic. The women's clinic. We were talking about writing that. So there's sort of
childcare.
So
there was child kind of care collective.
There was a whole series,
including childcare for feminist functions. Do you remember that?
So
the boys did that one.
But also just in a political context was that many of us had come out of the youth movement, student, the new left, student movement, and so on. And a lot of that had fractured at this point. There was a lot of kind of infighting. And there was the beginning of infighting even in the feminist movement. There was definitely fighting within the SDS had ended at this point. And so a lot of the context of what we were thinking about was sort of the importance of cultural events, that there was a political and a cultural, that the personal was political, and that the cultural piece was an important part of developing some kind of larger context. People were looking for community, were looking for a place to be, and that sort of that context, I think, sparked much of what happened for us.
So I want to just say one thing about the actual origins, which is that I think what happened was that Stevie and I, it was my boyfriend at the time, went to Berkeley on a trip and had dinner at a place called La Peña. And La Peña is the name for the centers that were in Chile where people gathered to hear music and talk and live revolution. And there was just a wonderful feeling at La Peña in Berkeley, which was there were signs up with all kinds of amazing events every day of the week, and we looked at each other, and we were sitting at a big table that was made out of an electric spool, and in the center, they had figured out how to suspend little shiny rocks in polyurethane, and we thought, whoa, that's cool. We could make one of those, so we came back and shared with our friends this great idea that we would have a place like La Peña, where because that's how revolutions happen, which is they gather around where people can have fun together and dance and have music so that's something I remember.
Yeah, so we're on historical context, right? Yeah, I remember feeling that it was the best of all possible worlds, that here was a way that mysteriously I could both represent my political beliefs and beliefs about change, and also play the piano a lot. So that, and I think the other thing I would add about the historical context that we talked a little bit downstairs is that it was such a like a meteor kind of the cafe time. It's like this rising and falling all in a very short number of years, not just that the cafe came and went in a relatively small number of years, but I was saying how I remembered at the beginning of the cafe, or at least when we were preparing, which took a couple years, there was still something of an anti-war movement because there was still a war to some degree. But that by the time the cafe was over, I remember going to this demonstration at, it was supposed to be the October 14th coalition. And getting to the North Park blocks, and there were like 17 people there. And it was just, you know, it was such a, I don't know.
You know, I don't, the only thing that I really have to add is that I think that so many of us at that time felt really strongly about the way in which making decisions and the way things were the way decisions were being made in general in society at that time were anti-democratic, and I think that we joined among, I mean, you know, whether it was collective households or other institutions that really began to look at, well, how can we do this in a more egalitarian and collective manner? And I think that's really a significant thing to do. And, you know, we were talking a little bit earlier about how on the left there was a lot of sectarianism when we first started, and, you know, and there, and to see a place that didn't have that kind of sense of, you know, we are right, I guess, I think was a really good thing, but instead be a place that people who had different perspectives could come together and have conversation about how to move beyond that. And so I think that's one of the roles that we served.
So as we talk about the origins, it occurs to me that probably everybody got involved who got involved in the cafe for really different reasons. I mean, you know, because as you were talking, Peter, and it sounded so important, I was thinking how I just couldn't stand working. And I thought, well, maybe this would be more fun. I'm serious. I thought, well, maybe if, you know, we could gather with our friends and you know, cook and hang out, and you know, I just really thought that was a great idea, and that people would come, and in fact there was some aspect of that that we got to work where it was pretty fun, a lot of fun, and so that was something I think that we did achieve.
Yes.
Yeah, but I was just saying in terms of origins, do you have a sense of what drew you or what, you know, what got you into it?
Wow.
Yeah, good question.
Well, part of it was probably the wanting, I mean, I think they did have this sense of sort of doing something with your friends, you know, that was kind of cool. It was we had a lot of friends. Interestingly enough, we were talking earlier, I think a lot of us very few of us were from Portland. Most of us came, many of us came. And then we finally met some people from Portland. That was a shock. People actually grew up here. But but so part of it was that we had, you know, I think a nice wide circle of friends, and certainly part of it was this the idea that since we had to work, it'd be more fun to work with each other than for somebody else. There was a kind of naivete and a kind of excitement about what we were doing too, I think. And I do think that, I mean, I'm not sure, I mean, I guess we did actually articulate this, but we really had this sense that culture mattered, you know, that you know, and the fancy ways we talked about it was, you know, without getting too far afield, you know, we talked about, Kira and I got talking about Gramsci and this whole idea of sort of, you know, that this cultural hegemony idea, and that we would create another space where some of the norms that people had didn't, you know, that we could change them, that was a way of being political. Because I think we were all struggling with, you know, what's how are we political next? How do we influence things and influence people? You know, and again, a little bit naively, obviously, but so I think that also was a piece, was sort of creating this space where we would be comfortable, where we would invite lots of people, and where we would try to figure out an identity that kind of created a culture and a space that a lot of people could participate in. Mm-hmm. But we also wanted to have fun.
Yeah. Wow. As I think back, I realize that for myself, I mean, I was living with Andy and Debbie in a house on Southwest Maine, and we were like a little mini collective. I mean, we made all our decisions collectively too, and that's what we were doing. So that's what I did. I mean, that's pretty much, I can't really claim to have had a lot of original or, you know, unique purposes. It just felt like it was the next thing. It was the next thing to do that felt true to do in my life.
And my answer is really simple. I really, really liked the people that I was going to get to work with.
Just one quick thought. None of us really knew how to cook or have a restaurant or do any of that internet, but we had a lot of friends that seemed to know a lot, so we depended on them a lot.
Yeah, and you know, it's striking as we all talked this evening. We planned this for a long time, like a half hour before we got together. But it was striking how little we knew or thought about what it was we were going to do or how to do it, and yet we had no doubt and no hesitation that once we decided it's something we wanted to do, that we would go ahead and do it. And, you know, that is, you know, part of this context. It isn't just about youth. It really was the time that so many people were starting doing whatever they thought was the right thing to have and to do. And we didn't know very much. So we spent, I would think, about 2 years planning. And what that consisted of was, you can imagine, 2 years and about, I don't know, how many hours and hours we talked. We talked and talked and talked. And we just came up with things like rules, like we're only going to decide things, everything, by consensus. Well, what is consensus? Well, does that mean if five of us really think something should happen and one doesn't, how long do we have to wait to convince that other person? Yeah, really. I mean, this is the basis of many, many meetings. And then there were the practical things. How would you make a table out of a spool? And where do you get the money? We didn't have money. So what kind of place would we put it in? And what, you know, imagine how many questions. This is the planning section that I'm bringing up now, guys.
Okay.
I'm doing topics.
So, you want to say anything about planning, Andy?
Well, I don't think we called it planning. I think we had meetings. we would have meetings, and we would do reading, and we would have discussions, and I mean, one of the things we kind of want to probably talk at some point about is this whole process of collective decision-making and consensus, which has a really strong and positive side, but it has some negative sides too, right? Like, when are you going to get something done? I mean, the good part about our cafe is we actually talked long enough but actually did it. You know, I had been part of other groups that we talked a lot, but we didn't do it. So in that sense, I think we accomplished a lot through our meetings. But I do think that it was the beginning probably for all of us of that sort of thinking about operating with a consensus way of operation rather than a majority or something like that. But it was probably also to a fault that we took a lot longer than it sometimes maybe needed to do.
I was just had a flash when Andy said that of Debbie with a legal pad keeping the notes of everything, you know, everything from the most ethereal to the most particular. Who was going to talk to Mark about the building the wall? Who was going to talk to Anita about this or that? And which again reminds me of how many resources, how many artistic and practical resources were available to us at that time. It was pretty amazing. And that reminded me of what Peter said about just really liking each other. And I remember at times over the years thinking, as I thought back on the cafe, that it was kind of like the Beatles for me. It was like these four, I mean, somehow the chemistry of the six of us, very, very different people, very, very different strengths. It worked. I mean,
it did. And you know, the one thing to really know, I mean, to talk, I mean, when we talk about not having money, we really didn't have any money, but we had resources, and the resources were all these other people, and I mean hundreds of people, who felt like this was an important thing to do, and who put time and energy into this cafe in a way that, you know, for nothing, over and over and over again, because it was an important gathering place to be able to really try to work through issues so that we could go forward in a good way in society. You know,
I just remember having a lot of these meetings, but, what did we argue? When things didn't go well, do you remember any of the things that didn't go well?
You mean in our meetings?
Yeah.
You know, I don't really remember the meetings. I just remember that it took us so long, and then I remember tonight that we were all working.
Yeah.
So this was just something we did, you know, at night after work. I mean, you know, so we didn't really devote that much time to it. And so since we had to take everything from scratch, yeah, it just took a long time. Because, like, one of the things we had to do was just even, you know, gather kitchen equipment. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Where do you even get kitchen? I mean, none of us worked in a restaurant or had anything to do with business. So we were all school teachers and... I don't remember what we talked about.
Well, you know, I remember
a lot
time.
Of time talking, though. We did have a lot of rules, it seemed like.
Yeah.
Well, you know, my favorite memory in terms of a meeting was when we were trying to decide what the name of the cafe would be.
Oh, yeah.
And we were in your house. And Donna Pollock was downstairs, and we were trying to decide. And it took us hours and hours. We were up until like 3 o'clock in the morning trying to come to a decision. Do you remember that? The first one was the night kitchen, and then there was Joan of Stark, because Joan was just down the block. I don't remember the other ones, but Mountain Moving, you know, comes from Mao. You know,
No.
Home.
It's a Japanese woman poem.
Oh, it was. Oh, I thought it was. Oh, yeah.
Mountain Moving Day is coming.
Yes.
No, it was the woman's name was Yokiko. I looked this up in preparation for this. Yokiko Asano, Japanese poet, and basically it says, listen up, everybody, the women are waking up.
Yeah. The mountain moving day
the
is coming.
Mountain moving day is coming.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
That's right.
Was it? Oh, was it?
Okay.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, Peter, you were saying you remembered that we came up with a name.
Yes.
Did we think of it that night?
Yes, we did. Somehow somebody remembered it from that poster or something. Yeah.
And then
yeah,
we liked it.
Looked like a Mao poster.
Yes,
she
it did.
Had a
look
gun. It was the yeah. gun and the baby.
She had a gun. She was
posters.
A woman with a gun, and we liked that name. Anything else you want to say about planning before we talk about making the cafe? Because we don't remember what we said. And we will have a time for questions and comments, because we're just going to do this for another 5 or 10 minutes, and then we will open it up. But I just want to go to some of our stories about making it happen, because Peter was starting to say that we got help from a lot of our friends. And none of us had ever, again, we were teachers, and you know what teachers do, so we had never made anything. So we hadn't, like, built anything or used tools. And so we had a friend, Mark Ehrlich, and he gave us carpentry classes. So we had to learn how to do carpentry before we built anything for the cafe, and then we did go ahead and build all the furniture and the stage and the walls, and we turned a paint store into a restaurant. We built the counters and the drawers and the whole bit. And we made the curtains, and we did everything by hand. And some of us really, I later became a carpenter for a couple of years just from what I learned doing there at the cafe. So then we decided because of that, you know, anybody could do anything. And so that was sort of one of our rules, which is that when we started the cafe, you know, there was no cook and no cleanup person. Everybody did everything. The same way everybody built, whether you were good at building or not, and the same way you cooked, whether you were good at cooking or not. Anyway, so this is the building topic.
Well, I think both of those were good lessons for us. One, if we hadn't had friends that could do all these things, they wouldn't have been a Mountain Movement Cafe. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had people that worked at the Genoa. We stole their recipes. And we had friends that knew how to build walls. And that was probably one of the high points of the making of it was, those who remember, we had a fantastic mural that Anita did for us, but it was the whole lifting of the wall. It's a whole group of us lifted the wall, and one of the things that we wanted most of all was to be very inclusive. So we had many people, but we were also, I keep coming back to that, it was a turbulent time. I mean, it was the growth of feminism, sort of splintering of political groups, and so we would have discussions like one of the ones I remember was. David Shapiro had his shirt off while he was helping us lift the wall. And we had this debate about whether that was sexist or not for him to have his shirt off while he was helping us lift the wall. But again, we were kind of trying to be as inclusive as possible. In fact, we tried to make, I mean, that was the virtue that we were propounding, I think, which was good at the time. I do think that we achieved a sort of way of inviting a lot of different people, gay and straight, male and female, old and young, because they all kind of helped us in that actual building of the cafe, and much less constantly, the thing couldn't have run without the support and help of volunteers that in the community.
You are listening to a panel discussion on the history of the Mountain Moving Cafe, exploring collectives at work. This program was recorded on November 14th as part of the History of Social Justice Organizing series. The panelists are Ellen Goldberg, Andy Clark, Kira O'Hara, and Peter Thacker. This is KBOO Portland.
Well, one of the things, I mean, there were all, you know, though we were the background collective. I mean, there were literally people who would work with us, a large number. I don't think they got paid at all, but they, you know, like a couple days every week or whatever. And it was like, you know, so they became collective members, but not consistent. And a really wide variety of people came to do that work. And again, you know, and the thing that's really amazing about it was that really it was done by people because of that sense of wanting to be with others in community. Yeah. And, you know, again, espousing a lot of values that were very, very similar. But it was really wonderful that way. It was much bigger than a collective of six people. It was wonderful to have that experience.
And Peter, did you learn anything about carpentry? Did you learn something about carpentry?
Oh, this is my turn. Okay. Yeah, I learned that no, they should never give me anything to do, and the reason was because one day, and it was really quite frightening. But so one day we're trying to cut out a little piece of the stage so that you can put I don't even know the words. That's how bad this is. But, you know, like the top into these little cuts. And so I'm using a chisel, right? And I'm chiseling away. And I get a little frustrated at one point, and I hit the chisel, and it goes squirting right in. I still have the scar. It's right there. And, I mean, I literally, you know, it was like a fountain, you know. And Debbie just, you know, just saw it and went, oh, and just drove me as fast as she could down to the, you know, down to Kaiser. It was a riot. But, I mean, you know, hilarious. We really didn't, you know, I mean, on the other hand, I mean, like Debbie did this, and I can't remember who else said that they wanted to do this, but we made this inlaid counter. Yeah. And they said, Mark, we want to learn and we want to do this really good finish work, right? And they made a beautiful counter. Mm-hmm. They did.
I remembered what I was thinking of. It was when Andy was talking about the shirt and putting up the wall. And I was thinking about this whole idea of the personal is political, because that's a very profound thought. I mean, it continues to be a very profound thought. And granted, we had our extremes that we took that to, but... you know, what? Well, that's all.
Whoa. I was thinking about as we talk about making the cafe, we came up with some very unique and cool ideas. And I thought maybe we could just throw out some. Like, as people were talking, I thought, yeah. That free box. We had the most amazing free box. And like, where do we think of that? And then we had that the kids' corner, and we had, you know, cool toys. And because, you know, if women were going to come and they had kids, there should be a place where they can play. And it was like, and what about tips?
The tip jar.
Yeah,
gave it to different people every week.
Yeah, so we didn't...
God forbid
we should keep our tips.
We should keep any money.
I did want to just say, because they're not here, the other two people of the collective were Debbie Ruske and Julie Starobin, and they both said hi and wished they could be here, and I wanted to mention their names. And I also wanted to say the name of the cafe. The Mountain Moving Cafe was actually the Southeast Portland Community Center, for those of you who didn't know that. And we had a CETA grant for, I believe, what everybody had, which was $800 a month. And we did have Thank you. 8:33. And for those of you who were wondering how we survived because we were anti-profit, we did not keep our tips, we did not charge very much, and we gave the musicians all of the door, we did have one CETA grant salary, which we divided among us every month.
But we did give ourselves health care. I just want you to know that we knew that that was important.
How the hell do we afford that?
I don't know what he's talking about.
We did.
Oh. Okay. So anyway, any other things we did that people want to mention that you can think of? Go ahead.
Well, we were chuckling before that Ellen made a really good point. We had this thing called the Old People's Night. We just figured out the old people are younger than we are now, right? And who would call something the Old People's Night? But we did. We had this Old People's Night.
Old People's Music Night.
We would go to some senior centers and drive them to the cafe and have old people's music. So, I guess we could go now.
Yeah.
Kira plays old people music now.
So after we got going, and I'm sure some of you were there and remember what it was like, we did continue with consensus decision making. So even though what you saw just looked so like it was running so smoothly, behind the scenes we had long meetings. And I can remember one of our meetings, we must have spent more than one meeting deciding about the price of the chocolate chip cookies. Because the chocolate chip cookies were so cheap because we thought, well, you know, that brings in people.
Business acumen there.
It brings in people. And some people can't afford very much. And at least there's a little something. But then other people, like the bookkeeper, like Julie, who was, you know, keeping the books and trying to keep us afloat desperately, would say, couldn't we just raise? I mean, the price of butter is going up. So we used to talk like that for a long time. Because if there was one person who didn't want to raise the price, we would have to keep working on it. Anyway, that's a memory I had. And so we started doing the cafe. And let's talk about entertainment. Big deal for us because we were a cultural center.
We had, and those of you who...
Besides old people's music.
Besides the old people's music. First of all, there weren't that many venues in Portland to hear music then. It's not like it was now. There was a flurry of music happening in Portland then, right? Because there was women's music was starting. There was people like Chris Williamson and Holly Neer and Sweet Honey in the Rock, and we were on the circuit for them to come and the start of a great band that Kira will tell you about. And at the same time, there was a jazz and a blues and a lot of young rock groups that were there too. So we would have quite a variety of musical artists there. They don't even know it. They wouldn't know to this day, but Tom Grant played his first solo concert there. I'm sure he doesn't remember that. And Dave Friesen played his first bass solo concert there. And then, of course, we had the inauguration of Bobby Yaga and Felicidades and Upepo. And it was a kind of a, I mean, that was part of the, I think, was this flourishing of the musical community as well. And we were a place that they could play. And particularly because, as Ellen mentioned, we gave them the whole door. So even though it didn't cost much, they made some pretty good money.
And one of the things that goes with that, the corollary that goes with that, because they were such a wide variety of opportunities to hear folks, they, you know, that lots of different community people came, not just inside the left, you know, feminist community, but people, just regular everyday people. And we also, you know, and we had these desserts that were, you know, our cheesecake, which is Genoa's cheesecake.
We stole the recipe.
Yeah, but, you know, but our cheesecake got the Willamette Week award for 1975, you know, as best cheesecake in town. So it's like we served ourselves and we also served others. And that was a really good thing, because for a lot of folks coming in, you know, they hadn't, you know, I mean, we, particularly in issues around gay and straight, you know, people went to different restaurants. They went to different places. And this is a place that we could all come together and be in community, but also be in the bigger community as well. And I think that was really important.
Well said.
Just a little side note, at that time, the way that lesbians and gay men met each other was at the bars. Yeah. And it really was the first and probably only sober venue for gay people to hang out together. So we sure needed that. And another thing that we had, I'm going to say some unique things about, just to wrap up. One thing we had was a fabulous rule that if somebody like broke a quart, a gallon jar of milk and shattered it all through the cooler, that person felt so bad that the person who made a mistake like that would never have to clean it up. Somebody else would always be the cleanup person. Isn't that a good rule?
Yeah.
So we had kindness and sweetness. One thing is, we were all in a radical feminist study group, all the women, and so we always had assignments, and which we didn't have time to read. So while we were doing prep, chopping, one person's assignment would be to read to us. So we would be, you know, Juliet Mitchell and the Boggs, and, you know, some pretty heavy stuff. And if you thought that food tasted weird some night. Anyway, can people think of any other unique things about the cafe that stick out for you? Entertainment or events or?
Well, looking at Joan, I was thinking of the dance that Joan and Donna Pollock and Nomi Azule did, and the reason I bring it up is not to embarrass Joan, but just to say that a lot, you know, everybody, it wasn't, we didn't just have established groups. People really did just show their talents in other ways. Yeah.
And another thing that I loved about the cafe was, you know, we were usually there till around 2 o'clock in the morning, and anybody who wanted to stay and help us clean up, we would always put on these great records.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we would dance through the sweeping and the mopping. And I mean, I just keep thinking about, I said this to folks earlier, but, you know, thinking about Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, wake up everybody, got to, you know, build a new land. And it was,
yes. So, anyway,
can I just tell you about
please.
I think one of the most unique, certainly the high point for me, was on our first anniversary. On our first anniversary, because we really didn't know, we had no money and we didn't know very much about the restaurant business, we had 3 sinks to wash dishes with, which was all the code required at the time. But it was not a very efficient way to run a restaurant. And on the first anniversary, completely unbeknownst to any of us, did anybody know? I don't think any one of us knew. But all the people that came there had collected money, hundreds of people collected money, and they bought us a dishwasher. And they presented this dishwasher to us at the front door on our first anniversary. And, of course, we had a great party that night. But it was this, it still gives me goosebumps remembering that sensation of why did all these people want to do this? And it reaffirmed this idea, I think, of that there was some benefit to this creating this community that people wanted to be part of.
And the last topic that we were going to say, and maybe we should just have this be a whole group discussion, is, so what? Like, what did we learn from that? And is there any carryover? And what difference did it make? And what difference did it make in our lives, but in other people's lives? And is there any piece of it that when we look at the world today is useful or parallel or interesting? And I think we have things to say about that, but maybe you guys do too. So that's one topic for discussion, but also just any things that people want to ask or say or finish first. Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. So that's my question.
You don't get to answer it?
Well, I'll go after Peter.
After Peter. So that means you go, then you
go. Oh, okay.
Oh, you don't have to go anywhere.
Lessons learned.
We're going to discuss who's going to go next. You guys take
a
break.
We have a meeting about who goes first.
10, 15 minutes, and then...
On the one hand, I think it was a very unique time, and we were a response to a time when there was tremendous upheaval in the United States, and particularly in our generation. So I think in some ways there was a unique quality to it. But I think the issues are still all there. People are looking for community, the role of culture, how political and cultural events, how do they interact? How do you build? One of the lessons that has to be learned at some point is if you're going to affect change, you have to have a lot of people to affect the change. And that's always been our discussion: are we a small, tiny minority of people, or can we create institutions and cultures that can change and can be inclusive? So I think there's a lot that I continue to wrestle with, and in terms of how you build that and how important that is. And I think there are parts that you look back and you say, I was pretty young. I mean, we had a very anti-materialist perspective, right? Like, money doesn't matter, clothing doesn't matter, which wasn't sustainable. It matters a lot. You have families, it matters a lot. So there was a good side and a downside to sort of, not caring about material things in a culture that was overly concerned with consumption is positive. But we were so far out on that anti-materialism that I think other people couldn't relate to it, and we couldn't relate to it because we all got out and got other jobs where we actually made some money. So I think there are a lot of things that would be interesting to talk to with people about, both the lessons from it, but also kind of how it continues to influence us.
You are listening to a panel discussion on the history of the Mountain Moving Cafe, Exploring Collectives at Work. This program was recorded on November 14th as part of the History of Social Justice Organizing series. The panelists are Ellen Goldberg, Andy Clark, Kira O'Hara, and Peter Thacker. This is KBOO Portland.
Yeah, I'm interested in what other people have to say too. Just anybody in the room. Andy said the word sustainable, and I was trying to think about threads from now that might link back to then, and the idea that, this whole idea of sustainable growth, for instance, in terms of the environment and whatever. I mean, in some ways we did burn our candle at both ends, and you know, in the years since I've been away, like my only subsequent experience with a group of people like making decisions is I participate in a Quaker meeting, and the thing that the string that ties them for me is, of course, which I don't know, I've never been able to universalize this thought into a political formula of any kind, but is the idea of sort of kindness and paying attention to what each person has to say.
I mean, I'll be interested for those of you who are younger to speak to this issue, but one of the things that strikes me, I don't know if I have any lessons, but what I do know is that in my work at the University of Portland, I find so many, and in talking to students from all over, so many people interested in doing work for good purpose. And not, you know, and, you know, the number of people, they don't, you know, their whole department's opening on nonprofit businesses and so on. And so there's this, you know, there's an incredible upwelling, I think, of wanting to find work that does good for everyone. And so that, you know, if in any way, as you think about what we did, there is something to take from that, I'm very happy about that, because I really think that it's in that kind of, and again, it's there's a lot of students. I mean, really, an enormous number of people. They know that that's what they want. They can see that community is more important than wealth. And so how we can, you know, that's what I'm really hoping somebody will draw something from what we've said and be able to think about that, because I think that's what we were trying to do. I don't know.
I just wanted to add one little thing, which is I remember being a teacher at the Willamette Learning Center, and the teenagers who were all high school dropouts and were struggling to care about anything that they were learning. They hated school, and, you know, one of the things as a teacher that I was so excited about the cafe was that it gave them something to do that they loved to do and got them off the streets, and it got them together, and that is still what kids need. I mean, you know, there are so many people who are young and have energy and want to do cool and crazy things. And that's one of the reasons the cafe happened, because we had two or three alternative schools worth of teenagers. We had Open Meadow, we had Willamette Learning Center, we probably had about 60 teenagers who worked with us.
Clinton Street School, yeah.
Clinton Street School, all the alternative schools.
So you're talking about like getting the cafe together, painting and things like that? Or
Continuing and washing dishes and chopping carrots and cleaning up. Wow. And
some of them joining the collective. I mean, it was
You know what you didn't talk about were all the meetings that were there, and also you didn't talk about Women's Night. And one of my favorite stories comes out of Women's Night, so I need you to tell that before I take this out to the audience.
Okay.
Why did it end?
Okay, well, just Mary asked how did it end, and the people who were the collective at that time, it was a few years after we had all left except for Julie, and they got evicted, and then they tried to find another place, and there just was not a place that was large like that and affordable, and, you know, that many years later, it was just impossible. So they did spend quite a while looking, and then it dissolved, and I think Sarah has a question.
But hold on, please.
Would somebody like to talk about Women's Night? Kira, you want to say something about Women's Night? No. Okay.
Wait for the mic, please.
I just wanted a little talk about the effect on the neighborhood. And
how that influenced what went on in the cafe and around the cafe.
We'll tell first. Tell
Women's Night,
and then we'll get to the neighborhood.
Well,
that's a good question.
I think the story that Sandy was referring to was the there were a couple, but one night the mayor. The irony of this, right? Because it was Mayor Neil Goldschmidt. So looking back, anyway, Neil Goldschmidt came for the cheesecake because it was famous, and we had just won this award or whatever. So he came in his big car to get, and we went to the door and said, "No, this was Women's Night. He couldn't come in." And he said, "Oh, okay." Turned around and was a good guy and left.
One of the things that you guys haven't talked about is food, which is what your business was. Yeah. And I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about your process, about planning a menu, and was it a political discussion?
Everything was political.
But I mean, now food is such a political issue. Yeah. Right. Sources of food, types of food, organic. And I just wondered if all of those things were issues.
Yeah.
And
God, we were the first vegetarian restaurant. You know, now I noticed that, all over these restaurants called counterculture, they're vegan, they're vegetarian. But I think we were the first vegetarian restaurant in Portland. And we were the second to have a cappuccino machine. So we were kind of contradictory there. But, we knew if you weren't going to have meat, at least you had to have caffeine. Thinking today how important foodies are and the food business and, Portland in particular in terms of that. And we knew nothing about that. We really didn't. We didn't know a lot. I mean, we were cooking a lot of rice and vegetables at home, right? And tofu. So we spent a lot of time on cookbooks and debating the kind of food that you're mentioning. And certainly we wanted to get sources from the People's Co-op. So we wanted to get we did care about sourcing the food. We also wanted it to be good so that everybody would come, which I think it turned out to be pretty good. Again, we had help to get there. One of the things we did learn probably is that not everybody is as good a cook as everybody else, and sometimes when you have everybody do everything, it's not the most productive way to go. We also had the first, this is another irony, but I think we had Starbucks before there was Starbucks. We had Starbucks coffee because they just had trucks at that point. They didn't have stores or anything like that. And in fact, we had a food co-op right before they became a children's center. We did have a food co-op there.
Right. I remember, in terms of your question, that thinking again of Debbie and her legal pad, that along with the calendar for the month, we would also do the menu for the week. Mm-hmm. And then that would involve certain tasks. Like I remember we went down at dawn to the places along the river on the east side, like Corno's and places that had bulk. We would buy a lot of our vegetables and stuff there.
So this is like a collage of memory. Because while we were part of it, we were just a little bit older, and we still are.
Not anymore.
It's a lot slighter.
So I had teenage daughters, and Haley. They loved being there. And they didn't love going to places with us then. But that, and especially, I think the second room turned into a children's room, and we had a lot of straw stuff stacked up. They loved that because they could feel like they were contributing. Mm-hmm. Right? That was part of that. And now they were in their early teens. Now they're in their early 50s. Right. and they're doing good things. Yeah. But so the images that kept mm-hmm. One was of your house, mm-hmm. and it was the first window I ever saw that had glass shelves and all the plants.
Right? Oh, yeah.
And I've always since then had glass shelves and all the plants. And when I was coming, and every time we drive down 39th, there's always that moment of, oh, where's the cafe? But the other is when I was coming here, when I knew I was coming here, I did have this thought. I thought, oh, God, maybe they'll have the soup with the pesto.
I thought the zucchini soup with pesto.
Yeah. 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 Which I loved and still love and have searched in books for. I think the important part was it was our place. Mm-hmm. It was a place that we belonged in, and it was a place that took care of us and cared about us and let us care about everything else mm-hmm. going around. So it was that sense of collectivity on another mm-hmm. level. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. it's really, you know, there's a hole there.
Oh, yeah. Can I just make one quick response to that? Because we were thinking about lessons and so on. But, I mean, even when I keep saying it was inclusive at that point of groups that often didn't come together, let's say. But it wasn't as inclusive as we actually wanted it to be and still want it to be. And I think that's still the issue is like, how do we keep making that a bigger inclusive, right? So because there still were, it was sort of a, you know, fairly white, college educated, you know. In other words, we attracted a lot of people, but I think the ultimate goal was to actually make it even broader than that. And that continues to be an issue for us in general, is how do we make something that is more broad, that's more inclusive even than we have.
I just wanted to go back to Sarah's question about how did we affect the neighborhood, yeah. because I think what Andy just said, my personal feeling was not very much. But maybe I was out of touch with something, but I think there was always, as with so many things during that time, a little bit of a feeling of being an island in a greater sea for me.
Peacock Lane. The incidents with Peacock Lane and mm-hmm. them being somewhat angry at right. the noise and the music being too loud
right.
and making complaints to the police department
yep.
and, you know, that you had to make some adjustments to right. Peacock Lane.
And I'm glad you brought that up because somebody asked about how it closed, and I've always had the feeling that there was pressure to close it because of the noise. And, I mean, it's hard for those of you who weren't there to picture, it wasn't the place was not like a restaurant size because it had been a paint store. So it was more like warehouse size, and so sometimes 200-400 people would be in there, and very, very loud, and lots of cars, and lots of music, and lots of people outside doing all sorts of things, and yes, and my guess is you're right, that the neighbors pressured it to close.
While you all were doing the cafe, I was in Eugene doing a women's tree planting collective.
Uh-huh.
And so my memory of that period of time is that it was in the context of the Cultural Revolution.
That's right.
And Mao Zedong's influence uh-huh. on all of us in the uh-huh. ways that we related to each other.
Uh-huh.
Self-crit. We would work our butts off all day long and then have meetings all night long about how we did it or didn't do it or how we could have done better. But the thing that I took away from that period was an ability to get along with people in business and in the my later life, which was quite different. Yeah. And I remember working in a CPA firm, and there was some conflict with a coworker. Mm-hmm. And I remember just being able to diffuse the situation because I had worked in collectives and knew that it really wasn't worth going there to, you know, go to this escalated place. Yeah. So I think what I took away was that personal is political in all of my life. Yeah. And I imagine that a lot of us here did.
That's a great thing to carry that over. What was the name of the Eugene Women's Food Collective? Because we got food from them.
Starflower.
You know, I was saying Wallflower, and I thought, no, that's the dance collective. Okay, right. So we bought from... That was the other thing I think somebody mentioned, but the different collectives all work together. So we bought from the Eugene Women's Food Collective. And anyway, so go ahead. More questions or comments?
I was just going to put in about the song. And before that, to say I was an underage lesbian then. and that was like when somebody was saying it was non-alcoholic, I mean, that was the only place that we could go besides the bookstore to meet other women. And so Mountain Moving was huge, and Women's Night was huge for us. Mm-hmm. That poem, Mountain Moving Day, I think Red Star Singers did a musical version of it. It was on that album, and I remember the words, oh man, this alone believe, all sleeping women will awake and move.
That's you the know. End. That's
remember that,
perfect.
And that was the feeling of the time too, and really got that energy at the cafe and from the people we met there at that time. It's a very, thank very you. Exciting time.
Thank you.
I have a question, but I also just wanted to say hi. And
hi.
My name's Shani, and I'm just going to say this is Danielle and this is John, and we're all collective members of the Red and Black Cafe in Southeast Portland. And we were really excited when we heard about this panel happening tonight, and Sandy came into the cafe to bring some posters. We really appreciate that. But I just wanted to say, like, the work that y'all started, we're still doing that work. And this,
right,
like,
right
the talk
on.
Of these meetings and these all-nighters and are the cookies too expensive? Like, these are daily conversations that we still
all
have.
Right.
And we still, you know, we still plan and make our decisions through consensus, and we, you know, it's... a lot of blood, sweat, and tears every day. But I was, and where you said that there's a hole when you drive down 39th Street, we're on 12th Street, and we can fill that hole for you.
All
so
right.
Please, we're vegan, we're radical, we're anarchist, and especially when I heard that you guys had a women's only night, that was thrilling to me. We just recently hosted a trans women's only night, and we closed the doors for the event, and it caused some sparks even on the West or the East Coast. We got some pushback. You know, people were like talking about how dare this cafe like do this thing, and so there's a lot of struggle, and it does happen in kitchens and cafes and communities, and we're still doing that,
right,
and
on.
We want y'all to be a part of it. But I do have a question besides just an advertisement.
We like the advertisement, though.
We're on 12th and Oak. We're 400 Southeast 12th. It's right across from St. Francis Park.
Right.
Oh, and we have a bunch of cards for y'all because we want you to be a part of us, too. And
so
we do, I mean, we struggle every day just to keep the doors open as far as like, we are a business and we're not a nonprofit, but I'll tell you what, there's no profit going on. We reinvest it into the cafe. And just a few years ago, we had the opportunity to purchase our building because we did get kicked out of another building on Division a while ago.
Uh-huh.
And folks put a lot of time and effort into making sure we didn't close. And just a few weeks ago, we celebrated our 13th birthday.
That's right.
Wow.
And so, my question is, I'm sorry, I'm taking so much space.
No, please do.
I what the hell is a CETA grant? Times have changed.
They don't exist anymore.
Okay.
The war on poverty. It was part of the war on poverty, as I remember it anyway. You know, the Lyndon Johnson war on poverty. Bunch of money went into community, you know, like nonprofit community organizations. And It was, I think there had just been a slight recession or something, and so that money went out there, and then groups could apply for it.
It stood for...
Okay. Yeah, Comprehensive Employment Training Act. Right.
And it was used for all kinds of wild things, organizing things. Well, KABU had CETA people working there, too.
It also shows how far to the right we've gone, because that was a Republican program. So there you go. Yes, Nixon. It was Nixon's program.
Nixon. Yeah. Hey, so I just want to say I so appreciate all the talking and all the meetings.
LBJ.
Because I believe that consensus is so hard, but it was really the first alternative to top-down orders. Uh-huh. And the tenacity and resilience it takes to have those conversations about the cookies. I know. I used to say that, you know, we would have to spend 2 weeks having conversations about what color of paper to use for the flyers, you know? It takes so long. But, you know, last year I went to the National Coalition on Deliberation and Dialogue, and all that work trying to figure out alternatives is giving rise to mediation and mm-hmm. all kinds of new ways to envision structures for conversation that can help people figure out how to work through their differences and treat the differences of opinion as a resource instead of an obstacle.
Oh, great.
And I feel like the seeds were sown, mm-hmm. and I just want to thank you for all those sleepless nights. Oh. So thank you very much.
Well, yeah, and we were talking about that because we have not just mediation, but we have nonviolent communication, and we have so many different ways that now have become institutionalized in the mainstream society for people to talk and listen to each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just want to say I'm still shocked every time I see a man with a shirt off. I think, what is wrong with you? You know, haven't you been to the Mountain Moving Cafe?
Where they were wearing that shirt that is on the hanging
shirt.
There is Andy's shirt, and they actually made shirts for themselves before you even opened. Is that right?
Oh yeah, we had really they were undershirts that were batiked. You remember batik? Yes.
And one more thing, not too long ago in time, I can't keep track of it, but I ran across a whole stack of calendars that you all used to put out with everything that was going on during the week. And I can remember, you know, that was the first thing that went up on the wall at home was everything that was going on in the cafe, and so you would know, this is a night I want to be at the cafe, this is another
night.
What did
you do with them?
I threw them out.
Oh.
I think Debbie still has a collection of calendars.
Yeah, I have some,
I
too.
I didn't know who would want them.
The Historical Society would want them.
So I don't think you have any idea how much you influenced so many people. You know, at the time that you were making the cafe, I was working for the Forest Service up on Mount Hood. And I was living rurally. I was working for the Forest Service in Timberline Lodge. And when I came out, I went to the library where Mary Catherine Lamb, praise her memory, had made sure that every positive book about being a lesbian that existed up to that time was in the Multnomah County Library. And in the library, in one of those books, I can't remember which, it said something about the cafe and Women's Night. Wow. So, you know, I had been living in a completely hierarchical system. I had no clue about any of these things that were going on. And I came down and stood across the street on the corner of Laurelhurst Park about six times before I actually had the guts to cross the street and go into the cafe. And then I went in for a women's night. And there are so many ways that I could have encountered the way my life was changing that would have been so different if that had not been the place where I entered into this massive change, where looking back from what Kira said a minute ago, perhaps the most important thing was kindness. But there were so many other things going on that were a model for me. So, you know, you had a CETA grant. So when Marcy and I decided to start Keep Listening, Women's Wilderness Trips, we got a CETA grant. And, you know, and we modeled things. I don't know if we even thought about it, but this was the culture we had seen. So this is what we did. And then I have this other amazing memory of Meg Christian.
Yeah.
That Meg Christian concert, which for me was my first women's music concert, and you could not get in the door. You know, you had to do it twice in one night because there were so many hundreds of women, and that was just huge. But then this is a really completely personal story. I had been a very bad elementary school music teacher before I started working on the mountain. And eventually, over several years, I actually performed at the cafe. I sang at the cafe. And after the concert, this young woman came up to me and said, "You used to be my music teacher."
Whoa.
So anyway, I'm going to stand up because I want to offer this tribute to you and the other two of you and everybody else who worked in the cafe for all that you did.
Thank
you.
Oh, thanks. Thank you.
Anything else? But remember the bookstore.
Yeah.
The bookstore next door. Yeah.
Rose and
what?
Rose.
Yeah. What fun
Ruth
that
and Rose's
was.
Rose's bookstore.
I was the co-founder of the Family Circus Theater Collective.
And
I see all some of your faces, and we performed at the Mountain Moving Cafe. We premiered. That's the place where we tested out and tried our show and got your feedback and heard where you laughed and where you didn't, you know. And so it was a really great venue for us to, and helped us to maintain, you know, our work for over the years. And I think that there's, I mean, I'm surprised that there's not more of that kind of grassroots theater happening. And I often wonder about that. And part of it is because there isn't a place. Thanks. You know, the arts have really gone to the big halls and all those places. I mean, we were performing, you know, driving around in our old 1952 school bus. Trying to do theater in the streets and juggle and pass the hat. And the venues where we got to make some money really helped us a lot. And we struggled to be a collective too. I mean, we had a few CETA grants, and people would go on CETA, and then they would go on unemployment, and then they would go back on CETA. But all the money from the hats, passing the hat, and the few CETA grants we got, and the unemployment all went together in a pool and was divided out equally among everyone. And that's really what the collective experience was about. It was really about sharing our resources and sharing ideas and really struggling together to make what we're trying to do work. And I hope it's inspiring, you know, that we could share that more, that experience as older people, share it more with the younger people who are, you know, we have something to offer there, I think. Thank you.
Can I just speak to that a little bit, because I wanted to address the woman who spoke earlier, some of the things she said, which is that we had it easy compared to you. I mean, we did have these. It was a much more liberal time. It was a much more economically easy time. And so kudos to people who are doing things in these extremely difficult times.
The other difference I really feel young people trying to start something face than the we who were starting things in our era are very mechanical. They're like insurance. And, you know, things that you simply can't just ignorantly go out and start something anymore in the same way. It's really much harder. Yeah. So incredible what you're doing.
Yeah, we thought of that, which is how did we even, like, pass inspections? Did we even have inspection?
We did. And we did pass.
But,
you know.
But still,
I
somehow think that the standards are a little stricter now. So
I do remember
for
that,
everything.
Excuse me.
Go ahead.
We had these panels of material hanging between the things, and we had to take those down. I remember from the fire inspector.
Yeah. No, that's true.
Okay.
Well, I want to thank all of you for coming, and I especially want to thank Peter and Kira and Andy and Ellen for sharing all these wonderful memories with us tonight. And thank you to Tom from KBOO and Joe for videotaping it. And we look forward to seeing you again sometime, even if we can't see you at the cafe.
Well, we can go meet up.
We'll meet at Red and Black.
You know, the Red and Black Cafe was Ann Hughes's place. You probably remember that.
Sure.
On 12th there, right across from the park.
Okay. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you all.
You are listening to a panel discussion on the history of the Mountain Moving Cafe, Exploring Collectives at Work. This program was recorded on November 14th as part of the History of Social Justice Organizing series. The panelists are Ellen Goldberg, Andy Clark, Kira O'Hara, and Peter Thacker. This is KBOO Portland.
Don't let Rupert Murdoch control your newscast. The KBOO Evening News provides breaking news about local issues, from water fluoridation to immigration raids. We bring you daily coverage of what's going on in Portland, Cascadia, and around the world. Tune in every weekday at 5 for the KBOO Evening News on KBOO, your community radio station. Tune in every Friday at 3 p.m. for Roots of Rock and Roll. Dale Farr and Steve Bricker play rare and vintage records from rhythm and blues, jump blues, rockabilly, and doo-wop, from the birth of rock and roll, the 50s and early 60s. Roots of Rock and Roll, only on KBOO Portland.
KBOO is proud to present one of the greatest jazz films ever made, Round Midnight. Join us Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for this 1986 American-French film that captured the Paris jazz scene of the 1950s. Watch jazz legend Dexter Gordon deliver an Oscar-nominated performance. Round Midnight, the Clinton Street Theater, Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m., 2522 Southeast Clinton.
In conjunction with KBOO's presentation of Round Midnight at the Clinton Street Theater, tune in Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, when KBOO Jazz host Rita Rega talks with bassist Chuck Israels about his experiences in the Paris jazz scene in the 1950s, playing with pianist Bud Powell, the real-life inspiration for the film. That's Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, between noon and 2 p.m. on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
Hi, this is Justin Miller, KBOO's underwriting coordinator. Every day, local businesses support KBOO through program sponsorship or underwriting. These underwriters are people like you, progressive, diverse, and supporting real radio. So when you hear an underwriter's acknowledgement, consider giving them some of your business and telling them that you heard about them on KBOO. If your business would like to reach out to the area's 55,000 most diverse and progressive listeners, you can learn how at kboo.fm/underwriting, by email to underwriting@kboo.org, or call Justin 503-231-8032. KBOO Underwriting. Your clients are listening.
Don't let Rupert Murdoch control your newscast. The KBOO Evening News provides breaking news about local issues, from water fluoridation to immigration raids. We bring you daily coverage of what's going on in Portland, Cascadia, and around the world. Tune in every weekday at 5 for the KBOO Evening News on KBOO, your community radio station.
You're listening to KBOO FM Portland. I'm Don Jacobson, and Moving On will be here in just a few minutes. This program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Aladdin Theater, presenting David Bromberg Quintet with Jamie Leopold and the Short Stories, Wednesday, December 4th. Tickets and information for David Bromberg Quintet, December 4th, at aladdin-theater.com. And we're also underwritten by the Portland Saturday Market, open daily December 15th through December 24th for the Festival of the Last Minute. Saturday Market offers handmade art, crafts, and other gifts created by artists from the Pacific Northwest, and is located at Southwest Ankeny and NATO Parkway in Waterfront Park. Information at PortlandSaturdayMarket.com. Moving on, we'll be here right after the noon news.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Friday, November 29th. I'm Kristen Yount. Portland Police Union voted in favor of a new contract that will raise their pay 0.9%. Canine handlers will get a 6% hazard pay raise. Patrol sergeants are expected to receive a pay increase of 5%, presumably because they conduct investigations concerning use of force among their ranks. 677 members of the 950-member police union voted. In Pendleton, construction of a 32-unit subdivision halted 10 years ago because human remains were found on the site. Two bodies are over 200 years old. This month, the Umatilla tribe revisited the idea of finishing the development on the reservation to help the community grow. The development will have fewer homes, and there will be a buffer zone around the burial ground.